This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
I mean, this is the first time it's happened in 9,000 games, I believe, for Hawkeye to fail. I can honestly say I'm stood in the stand, and myself and my coaches, and I know Chris Wald and Alan Nil at the time, we never knew the ball across the line.
When I go home late at night, this is a song that I really like to sing right now, so I'll play it for you. It's called My Old Man.
Up by Dalian Atkinson, and Whittingham, who scored countless goals for Portsmouth last season, now showing he can do it in the Premiership.
Welcome to the My Old Man Said podcast. I'm David Michael, the editor of myoldmansaid.com. Joining me for the first podcast since the restart of the Premier League, Mr. Dan Rogers from the Villa Underground. Welcome.
Hello.
And Mr. Chris Budd.
Hello.
We are back. We spent the Sheffield United game in Match Club rather than Villa Park, and I think it's probably as pleasant experience as we could have had, considering the circumstances.
It was lovely.
Dan, did you enjoy Match Club?
It's replaced Twitter, so...
That in itself is a result.
That's the review.
That is a big home win.
So if you don't know what Match Club is, well, the first rule of Match Club is you can't talk about Match Club. Mom's patrons know what we're talking about. And the feedback's been excellent. So thank you for all your comments. Match Club is an excellent innovation. Thank you. These are some of the members of Match Club. Brilliant idea. Great idea. Thanks for setting it up. Mom's Match Club has been a success. Much better innovation than VAR.
In the bar low then.
Genius. Genius, somebody said. Match Club, great. Much better than Twitter hysteria.
Yeah.
So if you are a My Old Man Said patron and you haven't joined us yet, sort that one out before the Chelsea game.
It was great to talk to people genuinely after the game, and I think...
During the game, after the game, before the game.
And it was genuinely a nice step back from the chaos and delirium of Twitter. So
yeah, there definitely wasn't as much shouting as on Twitter.
I fully endorse it.
We like to keep it a private club. We're not bothered about numbers and views and likes and all that kind of shit. It's just something we set up for the good people. As they say in Fight Club, after Match Club, we all started seeing things differently. You can watch a game now with Villa, just be in Match Club and leave it cleansed and go back to your real life without being too depressed about what you've been reading and all the toxicity. Anyway, let's get on with the show. Coming up in this show, well, it's the beginning of a... I was going to say brave new world, but kind of a weird new world as the... season kicked off and we had our first experience of a, well, I think, what's the limit of people you can have? 300 people in Villa Park. These are obviously a mixture of players, staff, press. Boil it down, it's just like a ghost town. So we had our first experience of that. Also coming up, we go through the Villa news. There's been an update on Mr. Grealish's matter during lockdown. Also, the next round of games on TV have been announced as well. Going into the 3 points, Villa fans' favourite words or favourite abbreviation, FFP, has a there's a revelation about that. We'll also look into what happened as Arsenal flew to Manchester City. And a fan supporter European group has something to say about how broadcasters are representing games and also the need for supporter groups to be involved in the conversations when it comes to fans returning back to stadiums. Should we just crack into it? Have you, unless you've got anything you want to say, what have you been up to? Anything exciting? Just hanging out in Match Club, really. That's my life.
Basically, yeah.
Right, anyway, let's crack on with it. First Villa news, Mr. Grealish. There was one part of the lockdown scandal, which the main scandal was, you know, doing an NHS support video and then the next day just going against everything you preach to the nation in the video. That was one part of it. And the next part was the fact that he hit cars, and a few people thought that that was just kind of brushed under the carpet. But, you know, the police were investigating it and this is what happened. So he's now due in Birmingham Magistrates Court. I think it's the 25th of August. He's been accused of hitting parked cars and also fleeing the scene. So driving without due care and failing to stop at the scene. So we will see what happens there. I mean, it's interesting because it's the 25th of August. So Villa's season would have been, all being good, would have finished by then. So if he decides that he wants to go to Manchester United or wherever and he signs up and the magistrates, the judges are all Villa fans, they might say, well, 5 years, mate.
And an extra 2 years for that dreadful haircut.
An extra 2 years for wearing a Cornish pasty in your head in the Sheffield United game. So that's 5 years for the crimes and then an extra two for the Cornish pasty. So Villa would have pocketed the cash, and if it's Manchester United, their player will be behind lock and key.
Bail will be £150 million.
So, yeah, so Manchester United, if I was you, I wouldn't bother buying him. It's going to be a costly long-term investment.
Incarcerated.
Exactly. The second thing of Villa News, Sky Sports, they've got a full house of the next games announced for televisation. They're all televised, but Sky Sports have got the Liverpool game at Anfield and then Villa's home games against Manchester United and Crystal Palace. So I'm presuming they're on the paid service there, the old Sky.
Yes.
We'll never be on Amazon, will we?
We might get one game. They might get the last round of matches, actually. I wonder if they'll get the last day of the season and run them all.
I think they've only got four games, that's it. Why do you think Sky are picking on Villa in these games? Do they see them as...
This is Sky's classic working on their great escape fixture list.
Yeah, because Liverpool by then will be done and dusted, I would imagine, in terms of winning the league.
In terms of viewing figures, we're still going to be up there as one of the biggest, you know, we're not the biggest, clearly, but we're still one of the better, you know, certainly in the top 10 of TV draws in terms of fan base and, you know, global marketing. When you look at some of the smaller sides, you sort of Burnley's of this world and Bournemouth and...
Yeah, so
Villa have got a much more UK-wide and international fan.
The only other Villa news, really, I think this is the main surprise of the game was, I mean, obviously they were doing the NHS and Black Lives Matters tributes on the shirts, but when the kickoff whistle was blown, there was a surprise kneel during the game, because we don't play the national anthem, do we? So they can't do it, such gestures during that period, which I thought that was more poignant and powerful than the normal kind of token gesture stuff that happens. But obviously there's a lot of things connected to this. And I think something that Dean Smith said was quite organic on the day, was it not?
It sounds like, I think he'd mentioned after the game that it'd come from like the Villa players and the Sheffield United players were both in agreement that, no, this is what we're going to do. I think then obviously the referee would have got involved and said, is anything going to happen? And essentially, you know, do I need to liaise with the FA on what we're allowed to do? And I think Dean Smith and the players would have probably just said, well, this is what we're doing.
Yeah.
It's probably in your best interests to just let us, you know, we'll just get on with it. because it was only, what was it, about maybe 5 or 6 seconds. It wasn't like, you know, a minute long or anything. The ref joined in, which you'd expect him to, and I think everybody got on the same page without it being like a really forced sort of FA initiative, you know, when they have like minutes of applauses or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, these things, if they're suddenly starting to, you know, be considered at around offices and tables of the FA, then it's like, well, it's not really a genuine gesture. So we'll leave it at that. Right, going on to the 3 points. The first point, number one, it was FFP was almost an obsession with Villa fans for the last 3 or 4 years, I would say. Yeah. Here's some news we could have done with about 3 years ago. UEFA have put financial fair play, FFP, on ice. Essentially, what they've said is they're taking emergency measures because they want to neutralize the potential for, you know, loss of revenue, because obviously clubs' propensities to earn money has obviously dropped. In some respects, they're actually rebating Sky because there's no fans there. But do fans get lower prices on subscriptions for TV?
Don't get me started on that. That's really been one of those things that's knocked me off through this whole thing.
Yeah, anyway, so to cover the increased losses caused by football's shutdown, well, at the moment, I think it's more like sources confirm at this moment, UEFA sources confirm that clubs will be allowed losses in excess of 30 million euros as long as they show that this was caused by falls in revenues because of the shutdown. Creative accounting, here we go.
Yeah, I mean, especially with you know, the bigger sides with huge stadiums, you know, you sort of Barcelona's who are getting, you know, 80,000-90,000 every week, United getting 75 and people like that, they are going to make huge difference. I know Tottenham at their new ground, their revenue will have their match day revenue has probably doubled from the days of White Hart Lane. So,
and there's two contexts to that, I suppose. Is one that you've got the impact of COVID with a club like Tottenham who reportedly have asked for government help. Yeah. As well, around the indebtedness they now find themselves in. And I was reminded when we were looking at the show notes, actually, that the Financial Times ran an article probably about a year ago, maybe a year, 3 months ago, about how UEFA was under massive pressure, basically, that they were trying to enforce the FFP rules. But the biggest clubs could essentially, it's an allegation, but the big clubs could put huge legal pressure on UEFA and frustrate it and come from every angle, really. So yeah. This must be music to their ears to discover that they've essentially got an out on the basis that revenue has dropped for this period.
Yeah, I mean, Phil Shaw, who was on the last show, actually, he puts in Match Club, will this mean if we got relegated, would the owners then suddenly spend a go-go to get ourselves out, which... if we go down, I think we'll have enough money in the bank just from the Grealishes and your McGinns and anybody else that gets snapped up as well. So I don't think it will really affect us. Maybe when we're, you know, over the next 6, 7, 8 years while we're down there in the Championship, it will factor in.
We're down in League One.
Us and Leeds.
Us and Leeds, of course. I don't like even talking about this. So what happens if we're getting in the Championship? Because at the moment, why get depressed now? Because it's such a big pile of shit if we go down into the Championship that there's, you know, let's save that for a rainy day.
And the EFL, as we know from past experience, will find a way to shoot their entire league in the foot anyway. Yes.
Point number two. Dan Rogers, you talk about this one because this is one that you flagged up about Arsenal's aviation problems.
This one caught my eye as someone who has flown the route from Manchester to London, which is the most pointless air route in all of the world.
Because it's about half an hour?
15 minutes, yeah, door to door, which is fine. But it surprised me with Arsenal that they flew from Stansted to Man City less than 3 hours before kickoff. Now, this was on, depending on when you're listening to this podcast, that the weather in the UK was absolutely dreadful. And there's some weird things around it as well. You know, their chefs prepared the meal at the airport. Burger King.
Join the queue at Weatherspoon.
Join the queue at Weatherspoons, yeah. But that's a flight that, I mean, jokes aside, could have easily have been diverted on the night. More to the point is that they looked like a team that had been bundled onto a plane. They looked sluggish. They had two injuries inside 20 minutes. So some question marks around, you know, the toil, albeit a short flight, is, you know, it was the duration and the time they left themselves.
From my chats with the Premier League, the executive director, Bill Bush, he was talking about when they were talking about the neutral grounds, and the plans to potentially, you know, play these games in neutral venues. They were looking at Southampton mainly because of
proximity to the ground, probably.
Exactly, the airport being close to the ground. So, and the idea was you could fly in and out, and that was kind of safer than driving and traditional coaches.
It's nonsense.
But when they say there's no home advantage now, I disagree from that respect, because you've obviously just given a good example of what Arsenal encountered. But Villa have got, they've got a game against Chelsea. Not only have they had an extra game of preparation of this strange scenario, but they know the routine now under COVID at Villa Park. So they have that familiarity with that, which is part of the home advantage. It's not just crowd, it's familiarity with your surroundings. But, you know, there's a good chance that Chelsea will probably fly, you know, fly from London to Birmingham to get to the game. I think home advantage for Villa in these three out of the first four games at Villa Park, when you have that familiarity, you've got to take advantage. You've got to be, I mean, now we have to beat Chelsea, because as we'll discuss in the Sheffield United talk, that, you know, that was an opportunity ultimately to get a win.
But you'd be astonished if you were to hear that, say, for instance, with Chelsea. I mean, it's a late afternoon Sunday kickoff, I know, but that, you know, that if you were to learn that they hadn't left London till 1:15 on Sunday, you would be like, well, that's ridiculous, you know.
But then if they went on to beat us anyway.
Well, yeah.
But we'll cross that bridge.
In Match Club.
Point number three, the Fan Supporter Europe Group, which is the European equivalent of the Football Supporters Association here in the UK. My old man said it's members of both. They have the ear of UEFA. So they issued a statement declaring that supporter groups should very much be included in the conversation in terms of when football fans return back into stadiums, because, I mean, as I've written a few times on the website, we've been very much left on the sidelines when the broadcasters and leagues have discussed resurrecting football, which is still a debate to be had in terms of should they have done. I mean, I think you know our views clearly, and having watched that first game, it's not football, is it? Let's face it.
Rubbish, yeah.
They said that attempts by broadcasters to replace or imitate the unique atmosphere produced by fans, you know, augmented reality technology, pre-recorded chants, and other forms of artificial support represent a rebuke to match-going fans, which is essentially an insult to them. And I look at these video walls and things, and I just, you know, it just makes fans just to be these, like, I don't know, like hapless window dressing or something. It's downgrades supporters so much.
I mean, what I thought was quite amusing at the Etihad was, which always gets saying and referred to as the empty had, Man City had fans on the screens at both ends of the ground and they still couldn't fill the screens. Absolutely brilliant. They still had FA logo, Premier League logos in the empty squares. I thought that is just absolutely priceless.
My favourite from our game with Sheffield United was that the trolling of their fans by putting their fan mosaic up, if you like, to show their reaction to the non-Nyland goal. So we'll get to that. The look of horror. I'm so glad it was their fans and not us.
I'm glad they said something about that. This kind of art, you know, fake artifice. It is kind of, you know, you get to the point where they're trying to make it, oh, actually, we don't need the fans. This is kind of good. But, you know, we'll get to that. But there's a full statement. The full statement's on the website if you want to read that. Before we get on, I just want to say, as always, a big, big thanks for the patrons for joining up this week, and also for upping pledges. Patrons will know there's a tier system, and that also applies to Match Club, where you get a bit more functionality if you're in at a higher tier. So thanks to Steve Walton, James Wayhill, Phil Shaw, the great Phil Shaw, Jags as well, Liam O'Brien and James Burt for upping their pledges. And then thank you very much for joining up, Brian Ralph, Kieran, Greg, Kev Holloway, Leon Wild, Richard Morgan, Arnold Spleen and Campbell Naylor for joining up as well, and also getting access to Match Club. You can go onto the site, click on Patreon, and I'm going to re-spruce that up so there's more details on Match Club, etc. But just click on Patreon for now on the menu bar, and the details will be there. Thank you very much. Right then, the Sheffield United game. First game back in the Premier League. First game in the COVID times. Saw the team sheets. There was a fake one going around initially, which actually looked a decent lineup, to be honest.
Yeah, that's actually the team that I predicted.
It was the team I published on my website, so... So yeah, there was a slight edit, should we say, an hour before kickoff.
Yeah, well, I because Chris sent me it from somebody who should know better, and not naming names, we'll get you later. But I put it up on Facebook, but I just quickly put maybe dot dot dot.
Same.
And then on Instagram, just for, you know, you can just put anything up there on the story. But I left it off Twitter because I had my doubts, put it that way, because the font did look a bit shonky. And but the thing is, if that team sheet had been the actual team sheet, we would have thought that it would have been a fake, and somebody was big time trolling us, because it was logical in hindsight when you think about player fitness and who's responded better. Then obviously there's going to be a few people sitting it out who you may have expected, because it's not just who's the best player, it's what their condition is at the time. But the bigger thing was Sheffield United had John Fleck and their centre back Jack O'Connell out, so you thought, actually we could win this. And especially the way we started, I thought we started pretty well, Mr. Budd.
We did. We came out of the traps pretty well. I thought we had intent. We sort of moved the ball around reasonably well. Obviously, I think Horahan had a snapshot. The keeper made a smart save. Davis had the header, didn't he, at the back post, which
should have scored.
I thought he should have scored, to be honest. I thought if he actually gets there, which he did, he's done the hard work. You've got to keep your header down from there, really.
That's been my thing about Davis. Is especially, let's go back, it was against Norwich, wasn't it, in the Championship when he started. And he just completely demonised them. We scored a few goals on that day, and it was down to him, really.
Yeah, he bullied them. And he bullied the Sheffield back line, to be fair. You know, I think most people were surprised to see him start, but actually he, within about 15 minutes, everybody was sort of, he was the standout sort of, ooh, hang on a minute. Davis looks strong. He looks like lean. Yeah, he was mobile. He was really causing them problems, put himself about as well.
And when he came on earlier on in the season, he can take people on as well. There's a bit of dimension to his game. The only thing that's lacking is I don't think he's got that predatory instinct or that killer instinct, because...
It's my time to come in. You're absolutely right to say that, because he scores the goal that Al-Ghazi squares.
Yeah.
I like what I see with Davis. I do. I think I've got a lot of time for him.
What do you think it is? He's got to believe in himself.
But he didn't read what was happening, and it was, you know, the way that that ball was. It was a fantastic burst from Grealish, and for Al-Ghazi to run onto. There was only one place Al-Ghazi could put that ball, and he put it there. Yeah. And he didn't read that quick enough for me.
Yeah.
I mean, he was sent in with pace, but it doesn't matter. He should have been there.
Yeah.
He's not somebody. You look at Aguero, and you're thinking that he's got a voice in his head. Just telling him, you got to score. Mm-hmm. With Davis, you don't think he's got it in him. He just wants to put in a good shift and put in a good performance.
Yeah, that kind of moment, that's a goal scorer's goal.
Yeah,
I like him. And there was one in the second half, wasn't there, where both the chances to talk about in the second half, but it was the opportunity where he hammers it towards goal and the Henderson saves it with one fist.
Yeah.
That was another one where I thought, you know, a top striker takes that opportunity, you know.
Yeah,
I
actually watched the replay again after the game and today, and I think he did okay. But if I was being critical of Davis, and it's a little bit like when you hear about penalties being saved, when he's that close to the keeper, you've got two places you should put it. You've either got to go high into the roof of the net or slam it under the goalkeeper. Make the keeper go up, or he's got to go up or down. He puts it at a good height where the goalie can kind of put his hand out. He gives the keeper a chance, whereas I just think a top striker there, either side foots it at the pace, in the bottom corner, or he lifts it into the top corner and the goalie wouldn't have got it.
There's a third option, actually. You can do what Gabby used to do and miss kick it, and then it would go in, because it shanks in. The keeper hasn't got a clue where it's going.
Yeah, so you end up lobbing the goalie from like a yard.
Unless it's against the Blues, where it just automatically hits the back of the net.
That's what I'm saying. He would never have a clean finish, but it would go in. But it wasn't. It was never emphatic, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Those are the moments, aren't they? Those are the fine margins. You know, the first half header, the ball from Al-Ghazi, the one
and that
we
was
should...
shared across the team, didn't you think?
Yeah,
that
just not
you know
quite
with Hurahan's effort, with McGinn's effort.
The McGinn one's one of those where I think McGinn, after two or three games, because, you know, I think the commentator described it as, it comes to him on the edge of the box and his body shape, you know where it's going to go. So the keeper's positioning is already there. It's a bit of a Hollywood save. He hits it well, but you think if McGinn puts his laces through that and puts it in the other corner, the goalie's not even going to move.
Yeah. Just one final thing on Davis, Bert, before we move on. One train of thought is, you know, if he gets a goal or two, that'll give him confidence. But you're also thinking, does he have the attributes to actually be a good player in two up front? But, I mean, people were calling out for two up front in this game.
So. I am.
And I think he's a brilliant foil for someone else.
Yeah.
If you've got him with a guy who can run in behind, dangerous.
You can see every reason why we need to go up two up front. And I thought you saw that when Davis was withdrawn and we brought Samatta on. But you have to then sacrifice a midfielder. And I don't think we're so confident with our midfield to lose the extra man.
I think the only way Villa could do it would be to probably play a back three, wing backs, three in the middle and two up front. And that two up front would probably have to be like Grealish behind Davis. I think that's the only way you could accommodate a front two.
I mean, we have to factor in, obviously, the fitness situation, but, I don't, you know, do you blame Smith or is it the players? Were they too passive in this situation? Because you're in a situation where we need to win games. And people look at the table. People look at the table and they'll make excuses and say, "Oh, Sheffield United, you know, they're going for, you know, Europa League, whatever, could get in the Champions League." But the reality is, they were missing two of their, let's say, better players.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're two best players this season,
and they weren't really going for it. They were there to be beaten. And if we had a prop, you know, if we had a, I wasn't going to say proper striker. Well, I was going to play say proper striker. Let's say a proper finisher. I think we win that game.
Yeah, I think so.
And this is the problem. You can't go, oh, you know, Sheffield United quite high up in the table. You know, points not that bad. We're not in that stage now. We have to win games. And by the way, you know, you look at the fixture list and it's Manchester United, it's Liverpool, it's Chelsea, it's Arsenal. We've got to put some of these teams to the sword.
Yeah.
I would agree with that. And I think that's borne out in the, I mean, when we were talking in Match Club afterwards, I do, and having reflected on it, I thought that this might be one that we will look back upon as one that got away. And I put that in my tweet and in my article afterwards that, the percentage of possession was slightly more in Sheffield United's favour, but actually we had twice as many shots as they did. We had, you know, they only had one shot on target. We had three times as many corners as they did.
We had six shots, they had one, yeah.
Yeah, and my feeling across the game was, and this at the opening of what you just said there was around our approach, I never felt like we built up a head of steam against them.
No.
At the same time, to back you up, you look at the possession, it's kind of whatever, because I felt that we were the team asking more of the questions.
I agree. And I have to say, since the Lambert years, I've never been really interested in possession. You can have as much of it as you want, but if someone's got 1% and they win, that's the end of it. I attribute some of the way we played to lack of fitness. I thought you saw that in McGinn badly. You know, we had bursts of where you thought, that's exactly what we need. And then chronic lack of match sharpness. And the other part was what I just said, was that I never felt like we built up a head of steam. Is that down to a lack of fans in the stadium? Is that down to, again, match sharpness and that drive? For me, I think we were very, very conservative after 65, 70 minutes. I think the point became more important than the win.
Well, so, you know, the substitutes had zero impact on the game, didn't they?
I'd sort of taken the same stance as Dan and tweeted it this morning, that you would have never watched that game as a neutral and thought, oh, Villa are the team who need to win this. You know, you wouldn't think that was a game in hand for a team in the bottom three and as a big opportunity. I think, you know, the being the first game back and lack of fitness definitely plays into it. The lack of fans, I think, would have really pulled Villa through, certainly in the second half. You have to give Sheffield United a certain amount of credit in there. They've got the second best defence in the league, but I just thought that we never
statistically
really went for them properly. You know, we never had like a concerted amount of pressure.
Parking what we know about their season form. On the day they weren't very expansive. They didn't threaten. I think we were too conservative and it's an opportunity missed. And that's the benefit of hindsight, isn't it, I guess?
Yeah, but we played very deep, you know. Jack was taking the ball, you know, in his own half. Louise was very deep. We almost need the whole team just needed to step 20 yards further up the field and set up base camp on the halfway line, because the likes of Sharp and that, I think Mings had his number. McBurney isn't going to run behind. You could have played a slightly higher line and actually really forced the game, but we were almost happy to slow the game down a bit, which suits Louise, and I'm sure we'll come on to Louise. But actually that game, with how Sheffield are set up when they don't have the ball, with essentially it's almost like a flat five, you have to play at pace. And we just, you know, that's been the word, hasn't it, throughout the whole season, is our lack of pace in both across the ground in terms of just raw speed, which we really missed the likes of Gilbert and players like that, who can just give you a bit of punch and get you up the field quickly. And also the tempo of the game. And I know that's hard first game, but you look at how sort of City played later on in the evening against Arsenal, and it was so easy for them. But when they had to, they slow a game down to be efficient, and then they get into the final third and go bang, 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 and 2-3 passes, they've pulled you apart and scored.
The difference between the two, it would be my observation between Man City, Arsenal and Villa, Sheffield United, was that Man City, I think, we were talking about training ground players, but Man City are a training ground team. I think that they can take you apart in that way.
Yeah, no, in terms of Manchester City, I think if every game this season was played behind closed doors, they'd probably win the league.
Yeah.
Thump everyone.
The main reason is, and I've said this over the last few podcasts about no crowd, you lose some intensity and the speed of the game goes down. And I was on TalkSport and I asked Danny Mills this about, do you think without a crowd, the intensity will drop because, you know, the players aren't playing for anybody and they're not being boiled on? And he goes, yeah, it'll drop a little bit. But I don't think he realizes how much it does drop, because we witnessed it, in, you know, in both of those games.
Without a shadow.
And I think the technically better teams play well. I think when the pace does drop, if that intensity is not there, then you've got to take advantage of it and force the issue. And Villa, to me, were a bit disappointed in that respect.
Yeah, Smith had mentioned in one of his pre-match interviews, actually, quite interestingly, about they'd been discussing with the players. And I think it might have been Sterling who mentioned it as well before the two games, that Smith had mentioned that he was trying to get this sort of intrinsic motivation out of the players, in that you're not going to have a crowd pulling you through it. You've got to create your own sort of fire in your belly. And if you don't have that inner will to win, like they said, those old, you know, United teams under Ferguson had, you know, we had 11 winners out on the field.
Yeah.
You have to forget, you know, just block the lack of the crowd out and go, we need to win today.
I don't think we have winners in our team. I look at your El Ghazis, I look at the Trezeguets. You know, Grealish thinking more about his hair than the game, maybe.
Well, to take the Man United teams, those Man United teams you described, could, and we experienced this many, many times, you could get to 80 minutes and not be confident. You could be winning 2-0 and be confident. They were not beaten.
You could play them on the park and still lose.
Oh, we've got a group of players who...
We really are soft.
Well, we haven't got huge squad depth, that showed. And I think that when some of the subs came on, that you know, for everything that's likable about Nakamba, you saw straight away what the problem was. For everything that's maybe likable technically about Trezeguet, the guy's bereft of pace. And for those on the pitch, that Grealish, having seen the news today, you have to wonder, was he slightly affected by the fact that he's got a court appearance pending? And El Ghazi is woefully inconsistent. On the one hand, he's bursting forward and delivering a supreme cross at pace that's really dangerous. The next minute, he's trying to think the near impossible. You know, he's trying to weave around and trying to move the ball through gaps that aren't there. And
yeah, another issue is like off the pitch. I mean, the social media, the club's social media, and all, you know, a lot of fan channels, these players are hyped and hyped and hyped, and obviously they do see themselves on social media as like some kind of gods, and here we are in the relegation zone and they're not so kind of godly. Well, are the they
first, I mean, we're what, 10-9 games out now from the end of the season, and we're second bottom, and we're in a position now where the games are going to come thick and fast with the format that we've got.
I mean, July is crazy. I mean, this is why it would have been nice to win this one, and then you've got that extra game experience of this whole pandemic situation, football, to take in against Chelsea. And that's where you get your lift up and you get out of that bottom three. And that's how I saw the path to survival. After that result, not necessarily the result against Sheffield United, because if Sheffield United were, let's say, playing at the best, you know, if you get a draw against them, you go, yeah, hard fought draw. But you saw that as a, this is a wasted opportunity, and a little bit inside me died, I must admit, in terms of optimism.
We know that's because we know there's going to be harder games. And yeah, I think allowing for the fact that there'll be some freak results, one borne out by the circumstances, and then secondary borne out by the fact that I think there'll be some dead rubber matches that inevitably creep in as the fixtures wind down. One thing that did occur to me between the end of the game and us talking tonight was that our relegation last time was it felt inevitable because we were such a poor team and we couldn't buy a win. This time I'd be angry if we went down because I do think there's enough quality in the team. And I think it would be through not applying ourselves in games like Sheffield United that will ultimately do it.
And Arsenal and those sorts of moments.
Exactly my point, Chris, that it's not going to be the last 10 games that gets us relegated, but I think I'd be really pissed off if we don't seize our opportunity to somehow claw ourselves to fourth bottom.
Yeah, I mean, we won't get into that doomsday scenario at the moment in terms of who's responsible, etc.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Sure, but this situation could have been a hell of a lot worse, and a lot of people would have given up already if it wasn't for old Hawkeye.
Great segue.
I went down with my shears before kickoff.
Saved our bacon. That's a bit of an understatement. I mean, you know, people say, well, yeah, but there's still a half to go. But yeah, but it's a bad time to lose a goal. That was like 2 minutes before half time. And you're not getting that lift of the crowd when you get back on the pitch for the second half either. So made a big difference in terms of how we're all feeling at the moment. Bizarre.
It was bizarre, and I think it was a weird one, especially as the halftime whistle blew, because it was a huge let-off, but you couldn't help pondering how, with all of the technology, and I'll fall back to my default point in Match Club, really, it looked a goal live. And what I don't understand is how, and I'm happy he did, referee Oliver, who he deferred to his watch, and
it's Casio.
You know, hadn't had its battery changed since 1980. It looked a goal. I mean, the fact of the matter is that Nyland was almost in the inside side netting at one point.
I mean, Hawkeye says it was, you know, it remained functional throughout, and it was where the keeper was and the post and some player were in. It was in, you know, whatever. But the fundamental thing is, surely this is what VAR is for.
Yeah,
because that is an error. It's like the ref, all he has to do is call upstairs and go, can you have a look at that? Whereas it seems to be VAR is a one-way street, isn't it? The ref can't refer something. It's they just put it in his ear and you think, oh, Michael, you might want to take a second opinion on this one. It's if VAR's not there for that, Jesus Christ, it's like, you know, it's a line decision. I thought we'd got past this.
The Premier League, so desperate to just crunch the money and get this shit show without fans on the road that, and then you look at something like that happens and you go, what is this? What are they doing? Can't they, you know, this is not that hard to solve. The millions watching this game know instinctively that is a goal.
Yeah. Now, the whole sort of phrase, the buzzwords of this whole COVID for football have been sporting integrity.
Yeah.
And within the first 45 minutes of the very first game, the integrity of the whole competition has been put, you know, down the toilet because of technology, which is meant to be foolproof.
Well, that has to be one of the single worst errors.
ever,
VAR or otherwise, that's happened. And yeah, sporting integrity is the thing, and it undermines it. I mean, I'm on record across many channels. It underlines for me that
BBC, ITV, Channel 4,
whichever. I mean, live TV. You take your pick. but the point is, right, just parking us as taking off the claret and blue tinted glasses, it's, you know, we have been afflicted on the other side of those decisions all season. And I don't take the view that things balance out. I just think you get a shit decision, actually.
And I'm in favor of systems like this to cut out the crap. And if they're blind to it, then it's not the system, it's the Premier League and who bring out, you know, these rules that don't seem to work. They don't trigger VAR to happen, because if VAR was used, that goal is a goal.
I mean, how many times have I used the example whenever we've talked about technology of rugby? Rugby have just got the use of the technology and the lack of ambiguity in the rules perfect. You know, Michael Oliver can literally go upstairs and just go, I think it might be a goal, can you just check? You know, it's like, is it goal? Is it goal or no goal?
But anyway, let's not turn this into another VAR chat. I mean, the funniest thing about this was, and I like Chris Wilder when he said, I think the goalkeeper was in the halt end.
Yeah. And it's a shame, actually, because speaking of the goalkeeper, Nyland had actually had so little to do and had very little to do all game. You look at the incident from purely a goalkeeping point of view, even if he'd have flapped at the ball, it wouldn't have gone in. He could have just literally palmed it over the bar and it'd gone out for the corner.
Was it Hawes that knocked him in to the
Davis.
Goal?
Davis.
Sorry, yeah.
What a great goal at the hole. I mean,
clinical finish.
Maybe there's hope for Davis on the evidence of that.
It was the secret spy face that Nyland pulled as he retrieved onto the phone, onto the post and back around it, and looking around suspiciously as he did it.
At least, I mean, he flapped at something in the second half, but I think, you know, he'll see the clean sheet and I think that'll be enough to have him keep his place in the next game, I would say.
I think so, and on the basis of his form early season and that Leicester semi-final, he does deserve it, and we mustn't judge him on that one calamitous moment, must we?
Lest we forget that that's the first clean sheet we've kept in all competitions since Boxing Day.
Yeah, that's a massive stat.
It is. It is.
Along with Mr. Grealish, it's still topping the table with most fouls this season, 131, more than any of a single player in a single Premier League campaign since Opta started its data in 1998-99 season, and this season hasn't even finished yet.
It's the highest since Bosco Balaban.
But no, I mean, that's an astonishing fact considering we've got that 9 games to go.
That was the strange thing, you know, Grealish, for all his fouls, actually, I didn't think got fouled that much. He got a couple of clatterings, but he didn't get the normal sort of free kicks in and around the box particularly. We couldn't get Grealish into positions where, or really with any of the midfielders, you know, you look at where Hourihan's at his best and McGinn and Grealish are all at their best in and around the penalty area. We didn't get them there very often.
Finally, on the stats, Hourihan actually created 7 chances, which is the joint most by a Villa player in the Premier League this season. Grealish also created 7 against Southampton in December. But Hourihan was all right, just in summation on his performance.
I'd agree. And I actually thought his set-piece delivery was much better.
I agree. I thought it was quite dangerous from corners until he attempted the Westwood scythed one midway through the second half. And,
yeah. If we just single out one more player before we move on, I'd probably say Douglas Luiz. That tempo was dropped a little bit. He now understands man on, and I thought he had a... decent enough performance, especially in the first half.
I think the game suited him, didn't it? It was the kind of game that would work for him, where he wasn't necessarily, you know, Sheffield don't play a high press. He can take the ball off the, you know, your Mings and Horns of this world, and he can kind of try and run the game, and it allows Grealish to be higher up the field.
He earned his wages towards the end of the second half when Courtney House passed the ball. I think he was trying to reach Mings.
Yeah.
He makes up so much ground to make the interception, and has to come around the guy to do it as well.
Yeah.
It was a great challenge. And I mean, that was one singular moment, but I just to echo the point, I thought it was a really classy performance. I thought both Luiz and Hourihan had to play so deep though. Again, it reminded me when we had this bizarre formation where we had Lansbury and Hourihan in the Championship so deep, and it really affects us going up the pitch. That's a conversation for another day. But Luiz and I thought Hourihan had a solid game too.
Just quickly, what are you thinking in terms of the Chelsea game? I mean, let's pretend that everybody's fit and ready to go. What are you looking at in terms of up top and midfield? I'm thinking Elmo might come in for Konsa.
It depends how defensive, because I thought defensively Konsa had a very good game, but the reality is he's going to offer you next to nothing going forward. He's a very much in the, you know, the Carlos Cuellar style right back, isn't he, where he's not, you know, going to get to the byline and whip a cross in like Joubert can or like El Mohamedy can. And I think El Mohamedy and El Ghazi can be a bit more of or even Trezeguet can be a better partnership.
So what about midfield?
I wouldn't be surprised if the midfield stays the same.
Yes, yeah,
I could see him not changing it too much. I mean, I think the only change, if we were in a position to, I don't think he'll be back, is I'd put Joubert in.
I think he's, and it's Engels, is definitely out for two weeks.
I think sort of tactically, the obvious change, the first sub would have been to bring Trezeguet on for McGinn, get Trezeguet out wide and put Grealish in the middle of the field. That's the thing. However it's going to work system-wise, we need to find a way to get McGinn, Grealish, Hourihane 10, 15, 20 yards further up the field where they can hurt teams. Because I actually think Chelsea's back four can be got at.
I'd be tempted to play Grealish off Davis in like a number 10 type role.
Yeah, almost just give him a free role, because there was numerous times in the first 20 minutes where the system worked well, where you could see how Ghazi would pop up on the left. It was a very fluid midfield, because, you know, McGinn naturally tends to drift out wide to the right. You know, does the old sort of Beyonce stick his backside in, turn and runs in field. Didn't do that once in the game. You know, he tried it a couple of times, but just couldn't quite get up to speed.
Yeah, I mean, Grealish, if he is given that free role, then there's got to be a plan to how to utilise McGinn if he starts to Grealish occupy Chelsea.
I'm really interested, actually, that the big battle that I think will be great to watch will be Abraham against Mings. I think that'll be a really interesting battle. And obviously, it's a shame for Abraham, because I actually think I was personally looking forward to him coming back to Villa Park, because I think he'd have got a really, really good reception from the Villa fans. So it's a shame for him, for obviously, to be behind closed doors.
Anyway, we shall see. We'll cross that bridge. But I think we're needing something from that game 100%. I think we need to set out to win. Well, we need to set out to win every one of these games. But in the advantage column, as mentioned, the fact that we've had that extra game of this setup under our belts gives us a slight advantage in terms of in that respect anyway. So we need to take advantage, because once everybody's had an experience, that's suddenly nullified instantly. Right, shall we move on to finish the show with some underrated and overrated? We'll just do two this time, because obviously football is back, so we actually take up a bit of the show talking about that. For your delights, we have two more fringy players, Darius Kabichi and also Mr. Guy Whittingham, both of kind of a similar era, the Ron Atkinson time. Which shall we start with first?
Let's go with Mr. Kabichi.
Mr. Kabichi, who he cost us 200,000, which at the time we got Ekiog for 40,000, so we could have just bought four Hugo Ekiogs instead. I think that would have sorted out the defence there and there.
You have five for that money. Five, David.
Sorry. I thought Ron might prefer to just use that extra 40,000 on a new watch or something.
Yeah.
A tan.
But that was, we were talking about this earlier on off air. That was Ron Atkinson using the David Platt money to buy a lot of squad filler at the time. And I think Darius kicked in, I think it was about the fifth game. I don't know, that was when it timed in with him arriving. But he came from Legia Warsaw, who were traditionally like the best team in Poland. And, you know, it's occasionally sparkled in European competitions, but he played that I think it was the fifth game he started of that season, 1991/92. Played a good 20 odd games, 20, 22, 23 games on the trot, and then disappeared pretty much from there on in. I think Earl Barrett came along, and that was the end of that.
And Earl Barrett was a relatively big money signing at the time. He's 1.7 million, so he was coming to play.
Yeah, and I think he stayed on the books, and the next season, I think he played once. I think he came on as a sub in the last minute against Ipswich in the League Cup, and that was his only contribution for that season. Then disappeared. Went on loan to Sunderland because he was squeezed out of the team, and that was his main team while he was in England, was Sunderland. I think he played over 120 games. Then it was like a slow decline, Wolves, Carlisle, Darlington, where he had very little game time. But in terms of on the pitch, to me, he exemplified, he signs and you think, oh, hello, finally we got a right back. And you just think, well, you watch him a few games and you just think, is that all you have to do to be a professional footballer and pick up a nice wage? Just to be like really functional, not actually do anything out of the ordinary. You're actually watching him thinking he's not actually doing anything to justify his wage. You could slip in a very fit Sunday league player and, you know, not notice any difference. And, you know, that was a worrying thing. It always confused me as a, you know, when I was younger, thinking, oh shit, maybe I should have taken this football seriously. Because actually, as long as you've got your fitness and, you know, you're reasonably, let's say, smart in how you approach the game.
Towering height, David.
Yeah, you can make a nice living here without actually really doing much.
I know. I look back on a player like Kabich, and it's all in context, really, not necessarily personally just to him, but you know, it was obviously Atkinson's first season. And it was in a sort of a transition between, you know, the end of the Graham Taylor team and the Jove Engloss era.
Mm-hmm.
Atkinson brought in about 13, 14 new players that season. When you look at the players that we actually brought in, they would go on to be the core of the 94 cup winning team. Mm-hmm. You look at sort of Atkinson, Ekjog, Sean Teal, Richardson, Staunton, Parker, Earl Barrett, Bosnich. They all arrived, and it was like the end of the likes of sort of your Cascarinos and Cowans and Kevin Gages. It was a big transitional season. And it was, I think we discussed this earlier. You could maybe argue it was the first season, certainly in Villa modern history, of when you could really apply the Villa bought a squad as opposed to starting 11 and three or four subs. And then you had the youth team. This was what you had. You're starting to try and build a bit of depth in your squad. You brought Les Seeley and Bosnich to the club, and you already had Nigel Spink there. You know, he had three goalkeeper options. So I think with someone like Kabichi, he just didn't quite work out as best he would have. But then you look at the other players he brought in.
Well, he had the right back shirt for over 20 games, and then obviously decided that Earl Barrett was the way to go, even though he was really recognised as a centre back at that time.
And then he got the shirt in the Premier when it became the Premier League, and he held it, didn't he, for sort of a couple of seasons.
That says a lot, doesn't it? That we redeployed a centre half, and Barrett was a recognised. That was his position, really. I mean, we've said in previous pods as well, and this name does stick out as, for what I'm about to say, really, that there was a resounding fashion in the early 90s for trying to acquire European continental footballers, and he definitely falls into that category. And I think that the evidence for that is that he got 25 games at Villa, was found out, and falls down.
I mean, we haven't had time to do super research on this, but one thing I noticed that over about 9 years before he came to Villa, between 82-91, he'd got 46 caps for the Polish national team, so he played a reasonable amount of games over that period of time. As soon as he signed for Villa, never played for Poland again. Now, I don't know if that was like, I am retiring from international football. Sorry, see you later, Poland. Or if it was like Poland saying, nah, not again, mate. You're not playing for us ever again. Now you've signed for them. I don't know which way the cookie crumbles on that one.
Or if it was just he got the big move, got the relative paycheck of English football and just relaxed.
So after he kind of dwindled down the leagues, he got into, I mean, he was serious about football, because he got into management via some coaching positions at going back to the club that we'd got him from Legia Warsaw. And he played most of his games in Poland for Warsaw before he came to Villa. But an interesting thing is he had about 12 different jobs, most of them as managers across various different Polish teams, but he never seemed to keep the same job for more than a year. And he went 12 jobs across the Polish league, but not one of those jobs lasted a year, even though, you know, maybe he'd been at a club for 2 years because he had two different roles or three different roles. He didn't seem to be somebody that set down roots and got on with people, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
He was coach of Gdansk, who were in the second division at the time. And he, this is going back a few years, over a decade, he got done by the police in some bribery scandal. It involved, I think it was something to do with the sale of a sports centre in Warsaw. And he was suspended from coaching. And there's always something with these Villa alumina.
Yeah.
There was something shady. After the bribery thing, he carried on working, so it wasn't a serious thing. And currently he's still managing, well, I presume he's still managing. Last seen at Olympia Grzados. My pronunciation's way out there, but that's they were in the second level of the Polish league.
Underrated or overrated, then?
For Villa, he didn't really stick around and battle away. He got loaned out to Sunderland. So as I've said, I mean, there's no surprises where this is going. I'm saying definitely overrated.
Overrated.
Yes, overrated.
Right, to somebody who came to Villa with a bit of a track record, because he was banging them in for Portsmouth.
He was, very much so, very much so.
But he had a bit of competition in front of him at Villa. Yeah. I mean, you take up the story, Mr. Budd.
So Whittingham was one of these kind of, he came through non-league. You know, I think I get the feeling with him, he was one of these lads, a little bit like maybe a Jamie Vardy, but without quite such the glamour of it all, but... He came up through non-league and really worked his way up the divisions, got his sort of bigger break at Portsmouth.
I mean, his scoring record was insane.
Oh, it's absolutely incredible scoring record. I think he's in all games, historically, he scored 88 goals in 116 games, which is, you know, I mean, that is iconic territory for most clubs.
That's why we signed him.
Yeah, and I think the season before we had him, so the 92-3 season, he'd scored 42 goals in 46 games. I mean, that is... You know, in an era of sort of Shearers and Ferdinands and Fowlers, that stands up against anyone. So he deserved his big Premier League move to Villa. So he was a 1.6 million signing. Sort of started okay at Villa. I think he scored in his first start at Goodison Park. And then his career at Villa just never really got going. Obviously, he would have always had Saunders and Atkinson ahead of him in the pecking order.
But he must have fancied his chances. And I mean, in the context also, you got to remember that Dalian Atkinson was known in that period as a sick note. So we did need a third striker of, you know, decent calibre.
I mean, of course, we would have had a young, you know, Dwight York coming through at that point as well. So I think Yorkie would have been ahead of him potentially in the pecking order.
Yeah, no, but he was playing right wing at that stage. He was a winger.
So he was very much the third choice striker. You know, he found himself out on loan within the first season at Villa, which is quite baffling, really, unless he just thought, if I'm not starting, I want to go and play. He ended up at Wolves in the second half of his first season, which you don't find happens very often. Went to Molineux, and then he'd kind of left Villa halfway through the next season, you know, when Brian Little arrived.
I would say he's in the same, I was going to say bin, I suppose you can say bin, the same bin as your Tommy, as your Tommy Johnson's, like, not legitimate 100% starter, but can potentially do a job off the bench.
I mean, I think the difference with players like, you know, sort of Tommy Johnson and maybe like, I don't know, like a Julian Joachim, is they would come off the bench and impact a game. You know, Tommy Johnson win you a match, or if you'd start him, you'd always fancy him to score. Whittingham, he never necessarily took his opportunities when he did get them, and the opportunities were few and far between, and just never got that run of games or never got the momentum that maybe he's just one of those players like at Portsmouth where when he feels like he's the main man.
Bit like David Nugent.
You get them often, don't you, these guys who can bang in a hatload of goals. At a certain level, he's the main man. You know,
Steve Bull.
Of course, never got a shot in the Premier League, which is baffling, really, considering his goal scoring record.
Ross McCormack.
But I would say that a Ross McCormack and a Steve Bull and a Guy Whittingham are a long way apart. And that's because the one thing I remember about Whittingham is, and it captivated me as a youngster, was that he didn't start, he wasn't even an amateur footballer until he was 23. So, you know, he appears, you know, I think he's finished his military service or whatever he was doing for the British Army. And then he appears in non-league, you know, so that's 23. But It's 26, 27, I think, before he signs for Portsmouth, something like that.
Well, Ian Wright was a late bloomer as well.
And Dublin as well, I think, if memory serves me right. And that's the difference. You almost wonder that he appears and he was the right stuff, I guess, but a late bloomer. And my memory of him for Villa was that, we're just talking about Kibici, and he played 25 games, but he had a run of 25 games. Whittingham always felt like he... As you guys were just saying, that he never really got, you know, he was never the main man and was moved on quickly. And you look at how at that time of his career, you know, he was well regarded. He went on loan to Wolves when Wolves were a Division Two club or a Division One club at that point, and then played for Sheffield Wednesday for, you know, the substantive part of his career after that, which were actually is the latter part of what you would consider to be a striker's career.
No. Yeah,
and they were actually his best years. You know, he was really highly regarded at Wednesday. I think I remember him scoring against Villa. Actually,
Not as good as his Pompey years.
No,
but he was well liked at Wednesday. I do remember him scoring against his former side at Villa.
Mm.
No, that never happens.
No, ever.
But he was likeable, and I mean, from my point of view, just to wrap up, I think he was underrated.
Oh, I was going to say underrated. Well, he wasn't. He was like just good everywhere else, but at Villa,
We have the ability to do that to footballers, David.
It's kind of
just suck the life out of them.
And their soul.
I'm trying to go back in my memory banks to think if he got a fair crack of the whip at Villa or if we didn't play to his style. But I'm going to say he was overrated because I think I'm going to side to that, what we just mentioned about the player who just didn't make it at the next step up, which he really needed to make.
Yeah, I mean, at that era, a £1.6 million signing is not a massive signing, but it's still a statement. And I think it's when you look just down the stats alone, you would say, well, there's a player who's had one very good season at the league below and has got a big move because of it and then hasn't pushed on, which you do see a lot. You know, his lack of opportunities is kind of justified from Atkinson's point of view because they won a trophy.
Yeah.
And he was trying to get into a team that had finished second in the league the year before.
But this is another thing. That's why I'm saying overrated, because he was coming into a team that needed to go up one more step and they needed a stronger squad as well to take on the United's.
Yes. You know, going into his second season when you're thinking, well, maybe he's had a difficult run, but he's gone out on loan at Wolves. Second season, he's going to need to push on. Atkinson had gone out and bought John Fashanu and a young Neil Lamptey, hadn't he? And York's just starting to creep up the pecking order as well. So before he'd even got going, he found himself right down the bottom of the list.
Yeah, but he also didn't prove he had it, because there's no way, you're going to fear John Fashanu unless you're in the fight with him. But Ron Atkinson's probably not thinking about getting another striker in if Whittingham's firing on all cylinders and, you know, Saunders is and Atkinson is. There was obviously a need there that this guy wasn't up to it.
Agreed.
Right, I'm going overrated because of the expectations of him coming in and the opportunity he had to really push on from his goal-scoring days at Pompey.
Dan?
He's gone underrated.
Underrated from me.
Yeah, I'm actually going to... If there was the option to go just rated.
No, he's always trying to sit on the fence. Any opportunity.
I would say slightly underrated just for his lack of opportunities. You know, anybody who can score 42 in 46 games has got something about them. Yeah. Is it just the classic curse of Villa pulling a Villa?
I'm sticking by my club. I'm saying he's not good enough. He was not good enough for my club.
I mean, the fact that he left Villa and didn't go on to bigger, better things probably speaks for itself.
Right, that's enough of that for another episode. Will anybody who has a suggestions for the next underrated or overrated, do get them in. We're not doing a pantheon of status to end this one because we're too tired. It's 1 o'clock in the morning and we've had enough. Just a quick correction, actually. We did say that Juan Pablo Engel scored a hat-trick against the Wolves. Actually, Bud said, I don't think it was the Wolves. And Dan said, no, I think it was. So it was 2-1. Bud was outvoted. But actually, Bud was right. He should have stood up for himself.
Wow.
It was Wickham in the 5-0 trouncing we gave them.
In the yellow kit, wasn't it? In that horrible yellow MG Rover kit.
Yeah, I'm sure Engel would have preferred to have scored a hat-trick against the Wolves. So
I've Googled it. I actually cannot believe my mind tells me it was a hat-trick. So I'm quite happy it was a hat-trick as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, my mind does as well.
I don't believe this can't be right.
Why does my mind tell me that as well?
Didn't he score? I think he scored two braces against Wolves that season. I think he scored two against them at Villa Park and then obviously scored two at the Molineux as well.
Here we are again, 1 o'clock in the morning, masturbating over Juan Pablo Engel.
Late night porn.
Right, with that as our parting image, we will now get out of here. But please do subscribe on Spotify or iTunes, wherever you listen to this. Please do spread the word and also, you know, retweet and share articles and that kind of stuff if you like them. I know you're not the type of people to do that. We know that because there's lots of you, but you wouldn't think it's like the invisible society almost at times.
Which sometimes we do like that, but...
Oh, no, it's all good. It's just spread the word is the main thing.
Yep.
I was going to say if you meet your friends down at Villa Park, but that's not going to happen. But if you're feeling a bit left out on the lurch during these behind closed door games and... You've been a patron before. It's a whole new world now with Match Club. So please do check into that. Right. Until next time, it's goodbye from me and it's goodbye from them.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.